No one's had a chance to study the effect upon the wild salmon. Or can they, in fact, pollute the wild salmon in kind?
The U.S. House says no to genetically modified salmon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 16th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, grant money to tap Indigenous knowledge in Alaska.
This fund seeks to identify and invite the strategies that Alaska Native communities have for some of our state's most pressing issues.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
The U.S. House has voted to bar the Food and Drug Administration from approving genetically modified salmon for human consumption. Alaska Representative Don Young sponsored the amendment, which passed by voice vote last night and is part of a farm spending bill.
They were going to declare it an edible fish and then make it legal in the markets. And my point is, no one's had a chance to study the effect upon the wild salmon. Or can they, in fact, pollute the wild salmon in kind? And so I argue until that's done, there should be no making it legal.
Young says he's concerned about the health impacts of eating the genetically modified fish, their impact on wild salmon, and the competition they'll give to fishermen in Alaska. His amendment prevents the FDA from using money to approve an application for the modified fish. A Massachusetts company, Aqua Bounty, has created the modified salmon, which some call Frankenfish. It includes a growth hormone that makes the fish grow twice as fast as natural salmon. The bill banning approval of genetically modified fish has to pass the Senate to stick. Both of Alaska Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski are co-sponsoring a companion bill in their chamber. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to decide this year whether to approve the genetically modified fish. An initial advisory panel deemed it likely safe last year, but called for more studies. If the FDA gives its approval, it would be the first time a genetically altered fish or animal would be allowed on America's plates. The dream of getting a gas pipeline to connect Alaska's North Slope with the lower 48 is an old one, and in recent years it seemed closer than ever. But even as the company TransCanada works toward building a line, skepticism is mounting among some members of Alaska's congressional delegation that a project will happen anytime soon, if at all. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
It's like Alaska's white whale, always just out of reach, but dominating the dreams of many. A line linking Alaska's trillions of cubic feet of gas to lower 48 markets. If the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline could be built, why not a gas line? Congressman Don Young was part of the generation that got the oil pipe going, but he says a gas line isn't going to happen.
No way. No way. Not going to move. Got to be within the state.
By within the state, Young means maybe to Fairbanks or Valdez or even Haines. He points to the recent collapse of the Denali Project line by BP and ConocoPhillips as evidence the market's not there. And he hates the plan former Governor Sarah Palin put in place, AGIA, or the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, which puts up $500 million in matching funds for the project.
But they're not going to build that gas line, or AGIA is going to build that gas line, because the gas is too cheap in the lower 48.
Young says the project had its window years back when Frank Murkowski was governor and was dealing with the producers. Critics called his talks a giveaway to the companies, and Palin and the legislature scrapped it for AGIA. Frank's daughter, Senator Lisa Murkowski, also believes AGIA has failed. Like Young, she's encouraging the state to look at other options, such as a line to Fairbanks that could later be lengthened if the market's good.
We're now in a position where the conventional wisdom is there's not going to be a pipeline, AGIA didn't work, we're going to be $500 million out, and we're no further ahead in getting Alaska's gas to market, whether it's to the national market, the world market, or to the local market.
Murkowski says if the lower 48 line is dead, she's not sure what that means for the department designed to help get a gas line off the ground, the Federal Coordinator Office in Washington run by longtime Alaskan Larry Persily.
It does cause some question as to, well, then what do you do with that federal coordinator position if the direction of the line is focused elsewhere?
But Senator Mark Begich defends the post and says it has a big role helping whatever plan emerges. He's still bullish on a pipeline and says the demand for gas will only go up. But he warns it's up to the state to make a gas line real.
We have nothing. And I think the state needs to just say, here's what we're going to do, buckle up and go. And right now they're kind of like, I'm not sure I want to get in the car yet. Get in the car.
Begich says the state could be hammering out fiscal terms to make the project appealing to gas producers. The federal coordinator, Larry Persily, agrees. He says it's important the state figures out who takes the financial risks, who writes the checks, and what the rewards will be. But Persily warns that holding out for too good of a deal could jeopardize things.
The pie that we're going to split up, if you will, is a lot smaller with natural gas than it is with oil. Even if gas prices rebound, they're just not as profitable per BTU as oil. But it really comes down to whether Alaskans want a strong, long-term oil and gas economy.
Persily disputes the notion that a gas line is just a pipe dream.
It may be conventional skepticism that the project's dead, but I believe that's wrong. You look at the numbers, and natural gas consumption in the U.S. last year climbed almost 6%, hitting a new record. Meanwhile, production in Canada, which is our biggest supplier, is down 15% from just 4 years ago and heading even lower.
Regardless, Persily says it's not today's market the producers are watching. It's 10 or 20 years down the road. President Obama hasn't mentioned a gas line in recent energy speeches, but White House Deputy Assistant for Energy and Climate Policy Heather Zeichel says don't read too much into that.
This gas line is too important for Alaska's economy and for our own domestic energy supply so that we are going to, as an administration, keep trying to find ways to make it happen.
And is there any point that it would be like throw in the towel time?
Not as far as we're concerned.
So the project keeps moving forward, whether Alaskans believe it will happen or not. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A University of Alaska professor says there's a lot of value remaining in proven North Slope oil reserves, but the state needs to do a better job preparing for the future. UA Anchorage economics professor Scott Goldsmith gave a talk to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce earlier this week about the importance of the oil industry to the state's economy. Goldsmith says 16 billion of the 20 to 21 billion barrels of known North Slope oil reserves has been produced. He says the remaining oil will likely be worth as much as what's already been pumped due to higher oil prices.
Say each of those barrels is worth $100, then there's still $500 billion worth of oil to be produced on state lands. So there's a lot more value still there than there is oil. And we've been very fortunate in that regard.
Goldsmith says crude prices give Alaska another chance to do a better job managing the state's finite oil wealth. Goldsmith said state tax policy needs to reflect and balance different types of oil development.
You got to distinguish between the profitability of a legacy field like Prudhoe Bay and the profitability of moving forward with a new development like, a new satellite at Alpine, you know. And what the industry is looking at and what we should be looking at if we want to stimulate additional production is the profitability of that satellite field at Alpine, not the profitability of Prudhoe.
Goldsmith says undefined quantities of oil on federal lands could significantly add to Alaska production, but tax revenues from those properties would be much less than development on state land. Goldsmith says half of Alaska's jobs can be tied to oil development. He says state revenue from oil lightens the tax burden for other industries and on individuals who, in other states, pay an average of $2,300 a year in state taxes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what constitutes a federal hate crime?
A lot of people don't understand why the FBI gets involved in certain things and doesn't get involved in other things. So the most misunderstood thing is the difference between a hate crime and a hate incident.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by North Rim Bank, taking your business to the next level. With help from North Rim Bank, spot the turns and opportunities that lie ahead for Alaska. More at northrim.com. Member FDIC. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Alaskans got their annual glance at the personal finances of the state's congressional delegation yesterday, and they found Senator Murkowski and Congressman Young earning extra money from a range of investments that included stocks and real estate. Senator Mark Begich requested an extension to file his disclosure report later this summer. One-fifth of the entire Senate asked for similar extensions. Senator Murkowski reports that she, her husband, and their two kids have investments worth between $300,000 and $1.25 million. She also has, through First Bank, an IRA, a CD, and stock shares. The couple made more than $250,000 from their share of a sale of an Anchorage building on E Street, and the senator's husband, Vern Martell, made $10,000 from the sale of his former business, the Alaska Pasta Company. It's hard to know exactly how much any members of Congress are worth, because the federal reports only require disclosures within a broad range of dollar amounts. Additionally, members do not have to reveal the value of their primary homes or how much they owe on them. Congressman Don Young has between $115,000 and $300,000 in investments and holds $165,000 to $400,000 at the Congressional Credit Union. He also has life insurance policies in the neighborhood of $200,000 to $500,000. The congressman earned a small income from his Alaska teaching and legislative pension. Young did report income for his legal expense fund, which he disclosed in the gifts section of the financial form. That totaled $25,000. Both Congressman Young and Murkowski and her family continue to collect the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend checks. The Alaska Conservation Foundation is launching a new program aimed at helping Alaska Natives protect their lands. A new fund designed by an Alaska Native Steering Committee will provide a vehicle for Alaska Native tribes and Alaska Native nonprofits to protect the land, waters, and wildlife integral to their way of life. Polly Carr is a program officer with ACE.
Indigenous knowledge is at the center of the fund's framework. The reason for that is because we acknowledge that Alaska Natives have a thousands of years relationship with their surroundings, and from that relationship comes critical wisdom regarding the stewardship of our resources.
The Alaska Native Steering Committee has developed the grant guidelines and will make funding recommendations each year, Carr says.
And right now, we don't, as a state, give enough recognition to the importance of that knowledge and the solutions that could be coming from Alaska Native communities. And so this fund seeks to identify and invite the strategies that Alaska Native communities have for some of our state's most pressing issues.
Steering committee members include Vera Metcalf, the executive director of the Eskimo Whaling Commission in Nome, and Orville Huntington, Tanana Chiefs Conference Wildlife and Parks Director. The fund will support the incorporation of indigenous knowledge to promote food security and sustainable economies, connect the importance of environmental health, and address the impacts of climate change. Alaska Native individuals and nonprofit organizations may apply for funding. $100,000 will be granted in the initial round. Last week, an FBI agent based in California who specializes in civil rights took part in a public forum held at Anchorage's Fairview Recreation Center. For an hour, Supervisory Agent Peter Quapp told the packed room what constitutes a federal hate crime and what does not. KSKA's Len Anderson was there.
Agent Culp says the biggest public misconception over hate crimes involves definition.
When incidents occur, a lot of people don't understand why the FBI gets involved in certain things and doesn't get involved in other things. So the most misunderstood thing is the difference between a hate crime and a hate incident.
A common example of an incident would be a hateful but a constitutionally protected speech. A hate crime is an illegal act motivated by bias.
You have to prove that the subject acted willfully, that they acted because of race, color, religion, national origin of the victim, that they committed some sort of force or threatened force, a true threat, and that they were acting because the victim was enjoying a federally protected activity.
Federally protected activities include, among others, equal rights to public education, employment, and accommodation. True threats can involve symbols.
The noose and the burning cross, because of their history and what they represent, because of the civil rights movement and the violence associated with those objects, they're considered true threats, depending on the way they're used. If someone has a noose in their house, that's not a crime. But if they use it to threaten somebody and the victim perceives that as a threat, that's covered. The Jewish family moves into a house and the next morning they wake up and a swastika is on the front of their house. That could be viewed as a fair housing thing where they're targeted because they moved into a community.
Nor do the objects have to be their traditional targets. If an Alaska native or Hmong, for example, is subject to a burning cross and feels threatened, the FBI can investigate. In 2009, Congress passed the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act. Anchorage Police Chief Mark Muse said just because an incident doesn't meet the hate crime criterion does not mean it won't be prosecuted.
What we want to make sure everybody understands is just because a crime might fall short of meeting the federal definitions of the federal hate crimes doesn't mean it's not a crime locally. It's still a homicide, or it's still a vandalism, or it's still an assault, or it's still a robbery, and your state and local police will still investigate those. And if hate's a motivator, that's going to be an aggravator at sentencing.
Culp said that the Alaska FBI office has one agent assigned specifically to civil rights crimes. Culp said if an investigation demands more staff, additional agents can be sent. U.S. Attorney for Alaska Karen Leffler said local law enforcement partnerships normally make additional agents unnecessary.
When any incident where a hate crime is reported, we immediately work with state officials, with the police department, and with the FBI, and they will be responded to, they will be investigated. And it doesn't matter that there's one person assigned. There will be a squad. It will be responded to.
Culp added the public should know just how seriously the FBI regards hate crimes and civil rights violations.
It's fifth highest overall in the whole FBI. So it's behind counterintelligence, counterterrorism, cyber-based attacks against the U.S., and public corruption.
In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
The Copper River red salmon return has slowed down after a big start. This year's run is predicted to be a little more than 2 million sockeye, on the high side of the 10-year average. State biologist Mark Somerville says so far the overall return remains above that projection, but volume has fallen off in the last week. Somerville says that resulted in a reduced catch for dip netters at Chitna.
Starting about Sunday or so, we start seeing a slowdown. I would imagine we'd see it slowing down throughout this next week or so and into the following week compared to what it has been.
Water levels are also an issue for Chitna dip netters. Somerville says the Copper River has been running about normal, but it's now reported to be dropping with recent cooler weather. Ferry supporters are lobbying Governor Sean Parnell to keep money for a new vessel in the budget. But even if it survives his veto pen, it may not be enough. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld provides this update on funding the Alaska-class ferry.
The legislature put $60 million for a new ferry in the operating budget before adjourning this spring. But Governor Sean Parnell has said lawmakers spent too much this year, and some worry the ferry money might take a hit.
Delegation and other legislators from Southeast Alaska are really pushing to keep that $60 million in there.
That's Senator Dennis Egan, a Capital City Democrat and backer of the Alaska Class Ferry Project. He says that money, plus another $60 million already set aside, should get the state ready for construction. Officials originally planned to use a substantial amount of federal funds, but they decided not to because of regulatory requirements. One would have blocked an Alaska preference for contractors.
It would be all state funding, so we wouldn't have to worry about following federal guidelines on certain issues, and it would allow the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock in Ketchikan to bid on it and have Alaska jobs.
The shipyard hoped to negotiate an exclusive contract, but Parnell said ferry construction would go out to bid. The 350-foot, 500-passenger, 60-vehicle vessel would sail northern southeast waters. The governor's office is not ready to say yes or no to ferry funding. Budget Director Karen Rehfeld says the item, like hundreds of others, will be reviewed as part of the veto and approval process, but she says the administration knows about the need. Transportation Commissioner Mark Lucan says he's made his views known, but he won't second-guess Parnell, who is his boss.
From a department perspective, we definitely support the Alaska-class ferry, and we'll continue to support the governor as far as the timing on when and how to fund it.
The $60 million in the operating budget would go into the state's vessel replacement fund. Another legislative appropriation would be needed to dedicate it to the Alaska-class ferry. Transportation officials have been working on the project for several years. They have a preliminary design, and if there's no veto, there will be $120 million available.
That estimate is a couple years old, so whether we could actually get a ship built for that amount of money, I think remains to be seen.
That's Captain Mike Newsel, who runs the ferry system. He hopes the money makes it through the veto process and it's enough to build a ship, but he says that will be hard to know until the bids come in.
The basic design for a 350-foot steel-hull diesel-powered vessel with no staterooms for passengers but staterooms for the crew seems to be the general conceptual design. Specifics and actual details about that obviously remain to be developed during detailed design.
The operating budget was sent to the governor last week. Veto decisions are due by the end of the month. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
It's been 2 years since 18-year-old Taylor White died in a tragic drunk driving accident in Juneau, just days after his high school graduation. In a similar event last week, 19-year-old Gabriel Cart died in a crash, and once again, police think alcohol was a factor. Since his death, White's friends and relatives have worked through the Taylor White Foundation to provide teenage substance abuse and drunk driving, to prevent teenage substance abuse and drunk driving. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, foundation members say they're on the right track, but this most recent tragedy shows the need for more prevention programs in Juneau.
The car Taylor White was riding in the night he died sits on a flatbed trailer in the parking lot of the Mendenhall Lake Campground. Both the front and rear ends are smashed, the driver's side door is gone, and there's a gaping hole in the windshield. It's hard to believe anyone riding in it survived.
It's taken me about 2 years to kind of come to terms to even be able to look at it, but when I look at it now, I see hope.
That's Taylor's mom, Carol. She and his dad, Kevin, are the driving force behind the Taylor White Foundation. The nonprofit organization owns the car, which until recently was evidence in the police investigation of the crash. White says it'll be used as a roaming display around Juneau to raise awareness for the foundation's efforts to help teenagers avoid high-risk behaviors like drunk driving.
We had heard about it being done other places and that it really packed a punch for people when they saw it, and it was something that stuck with them.
To help tell the story, the foundation asked Thunder Mountain High School students to create a series of plaques to accompany the car. One tells the story of Taylor's life, one describes the best friend who found his body after the crash, and another the passenger who survived. 17-year-old Cassandra Eyre was a junior in the TMHS visual arts class that worked on the project this past school year.
I know if I didn't know what it was, I would definitely look at it, because even the car alone sends a huge message of, you know, this is something that is heartbreaking and emotional and could happen to anybody.
Before creating the display, the Whites wanted to make sure it was okay with Tyler Emerson, who was driving the night Taylor died. From the beginning, Emerson has taken responsibility for the crash, and he and the Whites have a good relationship.
I don't really want to be remembered by this for the rest of my life necessarily, but at the same time,
if it helps somebody, you know, it's worth it. You know, my reputation, I don't really care about it so much. If it can help somebody, you know, avoid what I did.
Emerson recently completed his prison sentence after pleading guilty last year to criminally negligent homicide. With credit for time served in a halfway house and a drug and alcohol rehabilitation program, he served less than a year behind bars.
As of May 5th, I've been out on probation, so just staying clean and sober, trying to figure out what I want to do with my life now.
Emerson was saddened by the death of 19-year-old Gabriel Cart in a car crash last week, one day after the two-year anniversary of White's death. Emerson ran into Cart the day before he died at a gathering out the road in White's honor. Police suspect alcohol in the crash, which is still under investigation. Emerson says that hits particularly hard.
I have these kind of feelings of, like, fault, you know? Maybe if there's something I could have said on Sunday or something. I don't know. It's just so crazy.
But he takes solace in the work he's done with the Taylor White Foundation, which includes talking to high school classes and taking part in a documentary about Taylor's life.
I definitely think it's making an impact on kids. I can just see it on their faces.
Carol White says it can be hard to tell if the group's message is reaching young people, especially when another teen dies under tragic circumstances. But all she needs to do is look at the foundation's board of directors, which includes several of Taylor's young friends, to see that it is making a difference.
The relationships that we've developed with these kids and the ability to watch them mature and begin to really think clearly and responsibly and compassionately is really, yes, that is one of the gifts of the foundation.
The Taylor White Foundation is also pushing to get driver education courses taught in Juneau high schools and to bring drunk driving simulators to town. The foundation also hopes to start a drug and alcohol free club for people under 21. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Barras in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.